Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in the book of Deuteronomy today, Shoftim, which means judges. It is Deuteronomy chapter 16, starting in verse 18 through chapter 21, ending on verse 9. Judges and officers shall you appoint in all your cities, which Jehovah your God gives you. For your tribes, they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert judgment, you shall not respect someone's presence, and you shall not accept a bribe. For the bribe will blind the eyes of the wise and make the words crooked. Righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue, so that you will live and possess the land that Jehovah your God gives to you. You shall not plant for yourselves an idolatrous tree, any tree, near the altar of Jehovah your God, that you shall make for yourself, and you shall not erect for yourselves a pillar, which Jehovah your God hates. Chapter 17. You shall not slaughter for Jehovah your God an ox or lamb or a kid in which there will be a blemish, any bad thing, because that is an abomination of Jehovah to your God. If there will be found among you in one of your cities, which Jehovah your God gives you, a man or woman who commits what is evil in the eyes of Jehovah your God to violate his covenant, then he will go and serve gods of others and prostrate himself to them, or the sun, or the moon, or to any host of heaven, which I have not commanded. And it will be told to you, and you will hear, and you shall investigate well, and behold, if it is true, the testimony is correct, this abomination was done in Israel, then you shall remove that man or that woman who did this evil thing to your cities, the man or the woman, and you shall pelt them with stones so that they will die. By the testimony of two witnesses or three witnesses shall be the condemned person be put to death. He shall not be put to death by the testimony of a single witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be upon him first to put him to death, and the hand of the entire people afterward. You shall destroy the evil from your midst. If a matter of judgment is hidden from you, between blood and blood, between verdict and verdict, between plague and plague, matters of dispute in your cities, you shall rise up and ascend to the place that Jehovah your God shall choose. You shall come to Kohanim, the Levites, and to the judge, who will be in those days. You shall inquire, and they will tell you the word of judgment. You shall do according to the word that they will tell you, from that place that Jehovah will choose. You should be careful to do according to everything that they will teach you, according to the teaching that they will teach you, and according to the judgment that they will say to you, you shall do. You shall not deviate from the word they will tell you, right or left. And the man who will act with willfulness, not listening to the Kohen, who stands there to serve Jehovah your God, or to the judge, that man shall die, and you shall destroy the evil from among Israel. The entire nation shall listen and fear. They shall not act willfully anymore. When you come to the land that Jehovah your God gives you, and you possess it, and settle in it, you will say, I will set a king over myself, like all the nations around me. You shall surely set over yourselves a king, whom Jehovah your God shall choose. From among your brethren shall you set a king over yourself. You cannot place over yourself a foreign man who is not your brother. Only he shall not have too many horses for himself, so he will not return to the people to Egypt in order to increase horses. For Jehovah has said to you, you shall no longer return on this road again. He shall not have many wives, so that his heart not turn astray. He shall not greatly increase silver or gold for himself. It shall be that when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself two copies of this Torah in a book, from before the Kohanim, the Levites, it shall be with him. He shall read it from all the days of his life, so that he will learn to fear Jehovah his God, to observe all the words of this Torah and these decrees, to perform them, so that his heart does not become haughty over his brethren, and not turn from the commandment right or left, so that he will prolong years over his kingdom, he and his sons amid Israel. Chapter 18. This should not be for the Kohanim, the Levites, the entire tribe of Levi, a portion or inheritance within Israel. The fire offerings of Jehovah and his inheritance shall they eat. He shall not have an inheritance among his brethren. Jehovah is the inheritance as he spoke to him. He shall be due the Kohanim from the people, from those who perform a slaughter, whether of an ox or of the flock, he shall give the Kohen, the foreleg, the jaw, and the maw, the first of your grain, the wine and oil, and the first of the shearing of your flock shall you give to him. For him has Jehovah chosen from among all your tribes to stand and minister the name of Jehovah, him and his sons, all these days. When Levite will come from one of your cities, from all of Israel, where he sojourns, and he comes with all the desire of his soul to the place Jehovah will choose, then he shall minister in the name of Jehovah his God, like all of his brethren, the Levites, who stand there before Jehovah. Portion for portion shall they eat, except for what was transacted by the forefathers. When you come to the land of Jehovah your God and gives you, you shall not learn to act according to the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you one who causes his son or daughter to pass through fire, one who practices divinations, an astrologer, or one who reads omens, or a sorcerer, or an animal charmer, or one who inquires of Ov or Yudoni, or one who consults the dead. For anyone who does these things is an abomination of Jehovah, and because of these abominations, Jehovah your God banishes the nations from before you. You should be wholehearted with Jehovah your God. For these nations that you are possessing, they shall hearken to astrologers and to their diviners. But as for you, not so. Your God has given for you a prophet from your midst, from your brethren, like me, shall Jehovah your God establish for you. To him you shall hearken, according to all that you asked of Jehovah your God in Horeb on the day of congregation, saying, I can no longer hear the voice of Jehovah my God, and this great fire I can no longer see, so that I shall not die. The Jehovah said to me, they have done well what they have said. I will establish a prophet for them from among their brethren, like you, and I will place my word in his mouth, and he shall speak to them everything that I will command. And it shall be the man who will not hearken to my words that he shall speak in my name, I will exact from him. But the prophet who willfully shall speak according to a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or who shall speak in the name of the gods of others, that prophet shall die. When you say in your heart, how can we know the word Jehovah has not spoken? If the prophet will speak in the name of Jehovah, and that thing will not occur and did not come about, that is the word Jehovah has not spoken. With willfulness has a prophet spoken. You should not fear him. Chapter 19. When Jehovah your God will cut down the nations whose land Jehovah your God gives you, and you will possess them, you will settle in their cities and in their houses. You shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which Jehovah your God gives you to possess it. Prepare the way for yourselves, and divide the three parts, the boundary of your land that Jehovah your God caused you to inherit. It shall be for any killer to flee there. This is the matter of the killer who shall flee there and live. One who will strike his fellow without knowledge, he did not hate him from yesterday or before yesterday, who will come with his fellow to the forest to hew trees, and his axe handle swings the axe to cut the tree, and the iron slips from the wood, and finds his fellow, and his fellow dies, he shall flee to one of these cities and live. Least the redeemer of blood will chase after the killer, for his heart will be hot, and he will overtake him, for the way was long. He should strike him mortally. And there is no judgment of death upon him, for he did not hate him from yesterday and from before yesterday. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall separate three cities for yourselves. When Yahweh will broaden your boundary as he swore to your forefathers, he will give you the entire land that he spoke to your forefathers to give. When you observe this entire commandment to perform it, which I command you today, to love Yahweh your God and to walk in his ways all your years, then you shall add three more cities to these three. Innocent blood shall not be shed in the midst of your land that Yahweh your God gives an inheritance, for then blood will be upon you. But if there will be a man who hates his fellow and ambushes him and rises up against him and strikes him mortally and he dies, and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there, place him in the hand of the redeemer of blood, and he shall die. Your eyes shall not pity him. You shall remove the innocent blood from Israel, and it shall be good for you. You should not move a boundary of your fellow, which the early ones marked out in your inheritance, that you shall inherit in the land that Yahweh your God gives you to possess it. A single witness shall not stand up against any man for any iniquity or for any sin regarding any sin that he may commit, according to two witnesses or according to three witnesses, shall the matter be confirmed. If a false witness stands against a man to speak up spuriously against him, then the two men and those who have the grievance shall stand before Yahweh and before the Kohanim, the judge who will be in those days. The judges shall inquire thoroughly, and behold, the testimony was false testimony. He spoke up falsely against his fellow. You shall do to him as he conspired to do to his fellow. You shall destroy the evil from your midst. And those who remain shall hearken and fear, and they shall not continue again to do such an evil thing in your midst. Your eye shall not pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, or foot for foot. Chapter 20. When you go out to do battle against your enemies, and you see horse and chariot, a people more numerous than you, you shall not fear them, for Yahweh your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. It shall be that when you draw near to the war, the Kohen shall approach and speak to the people. He shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, you are coming near to the battle against your enemies. Let your heart not be faint. Do not be afraid. Do not panic. And do not be broken before them. For Yahweh your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you with your enemies, to save you." Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, "Who is the man who has built a new house, has not inaugurated it? Let him go, return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man will inaugurate it. Who is the man who has planted a vineyard and not redeemed it? Let him go, and return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man will redeem it. And who is the man who has betrothed a woman and not married her? Let him go, return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man will marry her." The officers shall continue speaking to the people, saying, "Who was the man who was fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go, return to his house. Let him not melt the hearts of his fellows, like his heart is." When the officers have finished speaking to the people, the leaders of the legions shall take a command at the head of the people. When you draw near to the city to wage war against it, you shall call out for it to peace. It shall be that if it responds to you in peace and opens for you, then the entire people found within it shall be as a tribute for you, and they shall serve you. But if it does not make peace with you, but makes war with you, you shall besiege it. Yahweh shall deliver it into your hand, and you shall smite all of its males by the blade of the sword. Only the women and the small children, the animals, and everything that will be in the city, it is all booty. You may plunder for yourselves. You shall eat the booty of your enemies, which Yahweh your God gave you. You shall do to all the cities that are very distant from you, which are not the cities of these nations. But from the cities of these nations that Yahweh your gives you as an inheritance, you shall not allow any person to live. Rather, you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, as Yahweh your God has commanded you. so that they will not teach you to act according to all their abominations that they perform for their gods, so that you will sin to Yahweh your God. When you besiege a city for many days to wage war against to seize it, do not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for from it you will eat, and you shall not cut it down. Is the tree of the field a man? It should enter the siege before you. Only a tree that you know is not a food tree, it you may destroy and cut down and build up a bulwark against the city that makes war with you until it is conquered. Chapter 21. If a corpse will be found on the land that Yahweh your God gives to you to possess, fallen in the field, it was not known who smote him, your elders and judges shall go out and measure toward the cities that are around the corpse. It should be the city nearest the corpse. The elders of that city shall take a heifer with which no work has been done, which is not pulled with a yoke. The elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a harsh valley, which cannot be worked and cannot be sown. And they shall axe the back of its neck in the valley. The Kohanim, the offspring of Levi, shall approach. For them has Yahweh your God chosen to minister to him and to bless with the name of Yahweh. According to their word shall every grievance and every plague. All the elders of that city who are closest to the corpse shall wash their hands over the heifer that was axed in the valley. They shall speak up and say, our hands have not spilled this blood, and our eyes did not see. Atone for your people Israel that you have redeemed, O Yahweh. Do not place innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. Then the blood shall be atoned for them. But you shall remove the innocent blood from your midst when you do what is upright in the eyes of Yahweh. That was Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18, through Deuteronomy 21, verse 9. Shoftim, Judges, is the topic for this Torah portion. Its official title is Shoftim. Forget my little spiel. Any comments, questions, opinions, things didn't quite make sense to you that I can answer for you, help you out understanding this Torah portion? Yes, Rose. Cheek is a cheek, what you think a cheek is, the cheek of your face.
Okay.
And ma is usually an internal organ, typically around the belly area. It's mostly, some translation will term it as a stomach. Some debate whether it's actually a stomach or whether it's a muscle around the stomach. They're not quite sure which one it happens to be. In a tradition, it states that it is an organ which the animal is inspected with to find out if it was healthy or unhealthy. To inspect it.
Oh. Can you eat the entrails then?
Nope. There's no indication for food for that particular item. Not that organ. So there are certain organs you can eat and some you cannot eat. The entrails, which includes where all of our waste products are, those are not edible things. Those are disposed of. Well, you'd think so, but a lot of people make hot dogs out of them. So they, as casings around hot dogs, most of you have hot dogs before in your lives. The outside casing used to be very frequently made from the organ, from that membrane around your intestines. Sausages and such, yeah. Anyway, so those internal organs are not for food. Now, it's debatable whether or not the stomach is necessarily food or not. People debate that. The heart is usually classified as a food. It's mostly a muscle item. And though I don't like them, liver is classified as a food as well. It's just not my preferred food item. Maybe some of people like it more than I do. There's other food that are classified as could be eaten, but most, however, are not. Now, there are certain things which the priest is to receive as burnt up, so it should be burned and completely consumed in fire for those items. He doesn't eat it. He just burns it all the way up. No, not those items, no. But the other item, the foreleg, as well as the cheek, is what is for the priest's actual food, what he eats for he and his family. Now, this is a separate groupings of food independent from the offerings listed in Leviticus. So this groupings of food offered is Levites within your gates. So if you go to the book of Leviticus, the first like 5 or 6 chapters, it goes all these offerings you do, the burnt offering, the shlemim offering, the sin offering, all those various offerings you give. The priest eats some of them, and some of them he doesn't eat. Some gets all burnt up, all these various classifications. This group's food, that you may live in a town of Timbuktu nowhere, that has nothing to do with Jerusalem, you're far away, and you slaughter your animal in your town. Well, there are Levites around that live in your town too. That's how this is the portion that you give to them in their town, in your dwellings where you live. So here in Windsor, California, if we had Levites around here and we slaughtered an animal, we don't live in Jerusalem, assuming a temple existed, was functional. We wouldn't, let's say, fly over there for the general slaughtering of an animal, but any general slaughtering of animal, we still don't forget the Levite where we live. And Levites, we live here, the local, okay, here is your portion of my animal I slaughtered that is not the sacrifices that I offer up to God over in the temple. These are separate things. Make sense? It's like a gift, but to the local, ordinary Levites within your territory, your area. Now, also this Torah portion we discussed, that some Levite may wish to travel from here, if they live right here, to Jerusalem for some period of time. Though he's not actually a resident of Jerusalem, doesn't normally operate there or function there, but he's trying, he wishes to dwell with or to serve his God there for some stretch, maybe a few months or years, whatever it may be, before he returns back to his home. Well, this Torah portion also says he is allowed to do so, and he's allowed to partake and consume some, but not all, of the offerings given there. But some, as it says here, they're prescribed for only certain people who live there. He does not get to eat that portion. So even he has certain ways which he can choose to travel to God and serve God more closely, but he's still limited while he's there. He's still not actually truly a resident of that spot. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions or comments I can answer for you? Any issues regarding this Torah portion? Yes, Anne.
I'm looking at the passage where the man was, someone was killed in the field, and they didn't know who he was or which town he belonged to.
The tail end, the verse, chapter 21, the right. Tail end, the corpse right. That was found, right?
Right, and I noticed that, you know, the Lord says, a field, bring a heifer that had not been used or you know, had any kind of blemish or anything as well, right? To this field that did not have any plowing or ability maybe for growth.
Yes, it's a non-functional field. You cannot use it for anything.
Right, so it could be a rocky area or whatever.
Yeah, very rocky. Unless it specifically says no plowing, no sowing. So it could be a rock quarry.
Right, right.
That's acceptable. You could still use that, but you can't. It cannot itself produce food. That's its requirement.
But you still pour out the blood onto the ground.
Correct.
Wasn't that where God would say, let the blood flow into the ground?
Correct.
So I wondered about that, about the fact that, you know, you don't, well, I think even with the regular sacrifices, they would pour out the blood, mm-hmm. not on a field that would be plowed up or anything.
Correct. In that instance, it is let's put it on the ground where the slaughtering takes place.
Oh.
In the Torah, I forgot which chapter it is. I think it's coming up pretty soon. I think it's a couple chapters from now. It discusses the slaughtering of animals and such, and God makes a statement that says, you shall slaughter animals according to how I taught you, or how I showed you. Referring to Moses, he's relaying it through Moses. And a couple of verses later, it says, it gives the example, the citation of what he showed was to pour the blood on the ground. So all animals are supposed to have their blood poured on the ground, wherever you're at. That is the instruction we're given. Now, we could debate how we pour the blood out, you know, whether we pour it near the throat or the whatever. It doesn't make a difference. The point is that God's his instruction is the blood's poured out. Now, in this instance, the blood's poured out on a ground that cannot produce anything. No benefit can be made from it. No crops will be grown. And nobody presumably lives there, so it's not like a residence. It's an unoccupied valley. Now, it's assuming it's near one of the cities. Now, the valley could be far away from the city that actually is responsible. It doesn't really matter. At the point is you find one, which is a non-functional valley, and in that area there were more of them than there are necessarily around here. They're obviously more rocky areas and such. That's the functionality. So the offering is specific to, it seems like a wasteland almost, you know, like a wilderness, treated as if it's a wilderness. It's an area which you cannot use to produce anything for yourself.
Later on it says that the people will say that they did not see the shedding of this blood. Now, they meant the shedding of the man.
The man, correct, not the animal.
Not the animal.
Correct.
And now going a little further, I think, on it talks about the trees. And I always love it when God talks about the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Not to kill the trees if you're taking a town.
Trees that produce, in this instance, give you a citation of trees that can produce food for you.
Oh.
So not just any tree. So if there are some trees which we can eat from and some trees we cannot eat
from. The nuts and the fruit.
Right. So if it produces food for you, don't cut the tree down to take over the city. Because if reality is, let's say you take all the trees down to build your siege works. Take the city. What's left? Well, what do you eat? You just took all the food-producing trees. What value is the city? Now it's just a bunch of buildings. Mind you, the crops are probably already burned and trampled. So there's functionality there. Now, most trees you can eat something from. Not everything, but a lot of them you can. Basically, don't destroy the fruit-bearing trees. There's a couple of symbolic reasons, too. But go ahead. Yes, Jeff.
I think it was interesting that the command about not chopping down the fruit trees, things that would be beneficial for the future, is right next to the command for not allowing those folks of the nation, certain nations, to survive.
Right.
You know, it seems like harsh, but it adds in there that because they will teach you. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to talking about trees. And I thought that was, well, for those who are wondering, well, what are the long-term effects of leaving something around that can produce for a long period of time thereafter? Well, think of trees. Mm-hmm. If you go into an alien territory and you've got trees that will be producing, there are certain trees that will not be fruitful for a long term versus the ones that will be fruitful for a long term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about that. If you're going to leave these trees that will be fruitful for you, well, think about who you might leave behind and what their fruit will bear for your future generations. And we see that in Israel's history. The ones where they said, well, maybe God made a mistake here in saying these people should be totally moved out of the land. Instead, what did they do? They turned the whole hearts of the people.
Right. That's an interesting analogy. I noticed they were combined, but I didn't think about it that way. That's an excellent point. So in this instance, you can almost like you view the trees which are not producing food as the ones, the same thing as the people you're wiping out. They're not valuable to you, but that does affect you. That's an interesting point. Good point. Any other comments or questions regarding this Torah portion? Yes, Larry.
When you were saying, righteously, righteously, thou shalt judge, in the other translations it says, justice, justice there.
Right.
I believe that's the same passage. And I was studying that over the weekend, and it seems to mean, because that word that was used there for justice or righteousness can also be another word, which means, and I forget exactly what that one was, not very good commentary, I guess, but what it seems like it means is you shall judge righteously and you shall, in your judgment, you shall perform it righteously. In other words, you're not allowed to trick people while you're judging them into confessing.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that so much on all the cop shows on television where they say, well, we're allowed to lie to you if we want to so that we can trap you in your response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the scripture apparently says that's not okay.
There's a couple of interpretations of that. The one which you just gave is one of the common interpretations of that. Now note, in Hebrew, they do not have exclamation points and punctuation like we do. So when they wish to say that it's very, very important, typically the word's repeated twice. So God repeats the word I, for talking when he's talking to himself, a few times, like six or seven times, he says I, meaning as if it's still, we have a conversation. Let's have a conversation about something. And I get all riled up. So, well, even I will do this. That's in point that I myself, I'm not going to delegate. I'm going to do this. So God does that in repetition. So he does it for himself in his own actions. And not every place, but number of places where repetition happens, it's trying to emphasize how important. So right or justly, justly will you do this. It's like somebody yelling at you. It's really important that the just process, the righteous process, is what you will pursue. Some of our Bibles will translate them, you will surely do this, or you will diligently do this, whatever it may be, seeking justice, seeking righteousness. The idea is to greatly emphasize. Now, that's one of the other variations of, in general, Hebrew and biblical context. We do it with repetitions of words. But the other one is also a common, if people argue as well, say, hey, wait a minute, if he's saying, not that will you do something, but the process by which you will do it is also important too. And that is relevant. That is absolutely true. If you pursue evil means to get to a just end, the end wasn't just. We have that philosophy of the does the end justify the means or not? No. The method in which you do something also matters, not just the end result. So it's also very important. So both those are correct statements. The end does not justify the means. Deceit and trickery is not the solution to find what is true. Now, we ask ourselves, okay, what about Solomon and the two women with the baby? It's a legitimate question. Now, the wisest man who ever lived, now, was he tricking them? Now, think about that very carefully. Think about the story. Was he actually tricking either of the women? He wasn't, did he? He wasn't tricking them. He threatened to kill. He's going to kill the child. And the idea that it invoked the emotional response. Now, would he have killed the child? I think absolutely. I totally think he would have killed it. I don't think he would have even thought twice about it. Sure, kill it. He's King Solomon, and we'll discuss the nature of kings and judges shortly because that's part of this Torah portion. But his objective was to find out who's right? Who's telling the truth? Now, he didn't trick the women into telling the truth or lie. He found out what is their emotional response, what is their verbal response. And that's how he determined who was actually lying, who was telling the truth. Now, here's the next commentary on this, which the Bible, or the Tanakh, that story already fulfilled it for you ahead of time when it gave you the story to begin with about those two women. When someone bears a false report, what's the Torah say? When they are proven to be lying, then whatever they wanted against the other person is put upon themselves. The punishment is. Those two women, what was the punishment? Well, the loss of child. Well, the other lady who lied about it already lost her child. So is there any more punishment put upon her? No. Go free, you're done. She already received her punishment ahead of time. Because she'd have lost a child. Right. So he doesn't add to, well, but you also lied. Well, yeah, but the topic was the child. And what the loss of the child was the nature of the punishment. And so you cannot go beyond what the liar intended to do upon the individual they were lying about. Hence the limitation. The whole eye for eye, tooth too, that you can't go past it. You can't say, well, she lost child and she lied, so off with her head. Doesn't work that way. That's two punishments well beyond what was intended by the person who was lying. So we have these balance upon the judges have to balance what is true and right also and limit what judgment actually can, what is permitted, what's fair, what is unfair. You can't go beyond. Make sense? In some ways, if our modern day system would use that type of philosophy, you'd have probably a number of less false accusations going about, I imagine. I'm just guessing. I don't know, but false accusations would probably have a little bit reduction if you found out you lied and then the same punishment upon you. That may help a bit in reducing some of the court cases, I imagine, or at least some certain witnesses. Any other comments or questions about this Torah portion I can answer before I go into my spiel?
Spiel on.
Spiel on. So bet. All right, so let's move back a little bit. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 16. So as I mentioned earlier, this portion talks about specifically regarding judges with inside, I hinted on it earlier, I didn't discuss it in great detail. In this, the tail end of chapter 16 talks about judges and officers that you have to appoint for yourselves in all your cities. So every city gets their own set of judges, people who are in control of certain things, officers of your town, independent of the Levitical cities and towns and the six, now that there are six of this part of history, six cities of refuge, all of those are separate judicial systems. So every city has its judicial system. Then beyond the cities, every region or tribe has its judicial system. Past that, you go obviously into the national judicial system. So they all have these layers of judges and layers to take care of these tasks, both minor and major ones. So it's important we understand that each of these judges have their own amount of authority and limitations. So I bring this up to you because we have to understand that, as it says here in verse 19, of course, no perverting justice. Verse 20 says, the righteous or justice, you should pursue that you shall live and possess the land your God gives to you. So each justice system, every town, every city, every region, whatever, every tribe, has a justice system built up on the same principle. And what's that basic principle? The righteous you'll pursue. You'll continuously do it in that method. As opposed to, well, judge shopping. Does it work that way? There isn't a judge shopping procedure. If you don't like this, you go to the other one. No, it doesn't work that way. Oh, well, he's a hanging judge. It doesn't matter who it is. you the same system is the same system, like it or not. Now, I do realize that humans are humans. We all judge differently for different reasons. We all value and put weight on different things. That's the nature of choosing a judge and choosing officers. Ideally, or theoretically, you choose ones that put similar or Torah-based weight on all issues and all topics. That's the idea behind it. But obviously, it goes beyond that when they get too high in some of the circumstances. But what I want to bring to your attention, which seems relatively out of place, but it actually is not that out of place. The last two verses, chapter 16, says, you shall not plant for yourselves an idolatrous tree, or any tree, near the altar of Jehovah your God, that you shall make for yourselves, and you shall not erect for yourselves a pillar, which Jehovah your God hates. Now, there's, I guess, an old philosophy. Maybe it's not so much probably anymore, but there were places of judgment. Today we have courthouses. Wouldn't have courthouses then. It built courthouses for that functionality. And sometimes you may have to judge at an altar of God. We think, well, there's only one altar of God. Yes, there's one into the temple. But mind you, many tribes and cities had their own altars as well. Say, well, that's wrong. You can debate right or wrong. We're discussing right or wrong. We're discussing what people did. Now, in this process, I want to point something out to you. The tail end of verse 22, you should not erect for yourselves a pillar which Jehovah your God hates. What is that? What is a pillar that he hates? Asherah pole? Well, that you could argue it Asherah pole, but the word pillar isn't Asherah pole. It's a pillar. No, not a Christmas tree. The word itself is matzabay or matzabat. Now, I bring this up to you because we have to understand the nature of the law that was given. So remember the famous words. What was the reason the law was added? I mean, the Torah was given to all of us. What was the reason for it? Say it a little louder. For transgressions, for your sins, or failures for your sins. So, because of transgressions, T-I-O-N, right? Two S's? Oh, I'm Artemis. Ah, well, just something like that. That's close. Because of transgressions, the law was added. Now, this is what I want to point out to you in this statement here. The verse 22, you should not erect yourselves a pillar. It's not actually, we'll discuss it. We have examples. The Torah gives examples of what it refers to. It refers to pillars. So, matzabat or matzabay, there are two different words, means very similar. I believe, one's plural, one's not. They're the same, the matzabah, matzabat. are two different forms for the same item, same pillar. I'm going to bring you to a couple spots in the Torah, and let you tell me what you think it means. What the examples we give. So first, we're going to go to a simple one, which is pretty straightforward. Go to Genesis chapter 31. Genesis 31, because our Torah discusses the nature of what these things are. So Genesis 31, verse 45. Let's find 31:45. Hold on. Well, let's read it together. Verse 31, chapter 31 of Genesis. Genesis 31, verse 45. So Jacob took a stone and raised it up as a monument. And Jacob said to his brother, "Gather stones." So they gathered stones and made a mound, and they ate there on the mound. Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galid. And Laban declared, "This mound is a witness between me and you today." Therefore he called his name Galid. And as for Mitzpah, because he said, "May Jehovah keep watch between me and you, when we are out of each other's sight, if you will ill treat my daughters, or if you marry my wives in addition to my daughters, though no man be among us, but see, God is a witness between me and you." Laban said to Jacob, "Here is this mound, and here is this monument which I have cast between me and you. This mound should witness, this monument should be a witness, that I may not cross over to you past this mound, or may not cross over to you past this mound and this monument for evil. May the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, judge between us, the God of their father." Jacob swore by the dread of his father Isaac. Then Jacob slaughtered for a feast on the mountain and summoned his kinsmen to break bread. They broke bread and spent the night on the mountain. What did they erect?
A guardpost.
Yeah. It's a monument. It's a watchtower. It's some object to remind them. Now, is the object that God's talking about? Question mark. Is that the object God's talking about? Is that the kind of thing he's talking about? Well, you have to decide that. I'm not going to tell you what the answer is. You think about this for yourselves. This is an example of the same object used in the Torah saying you do not recommend, you do not erect one. I mean, look, okay, what is the functionality of that? Does God care about the object or the functionality object or both? What is that? The property marker. There are property markers which you could use as a pillar. Yes, Jeff.
Well, there's an example later on in the history of an object that kind of, you could say, changed meanings or lost its meaning with the snake on the pillar.
Well, that is example. Yeah, you're right. It had a functionality at one point, and it shifted over time. Now let's change to another example, because Jacob does this not just once. He does this a couple of times, and it's great for us. We get to read about them. So let's go back a little further in Genesis, Genesis 28. There's another one that Jacob erected, and we'll discuss what that example might mean. Can this be a similar type of scenario, or is it different? So in Genesis chapter 28, go to verse 18, as it discusses another one. I should jump back to verse 16. Sorry, let's go with first. We'll start in verse 16. Genesis chapter 28, Genesis 28, verse 16, through the next, 22. Jacob woke up from his sleep and said, "Surely Jehovah is present in this place, and I did not know." He became frightened and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the great gate of heavens." Jacob arose early in the morning, took the stone that he placed around his head, and set it up as a pillar. He poured oil on its top. He named the place Bethel. However, Luz was the city's name originally. Then Jacob took a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and guard me on this way that I am going, and will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I return in peace to my father's house, God will be God to me. And then this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall become the house of God, and whatever you will give me, I shall repeatedly tithe to you." Now, that is a little bit not so much a marker or witness between two men like Laban and Jacob's other example I read previously, right? The example with Laban and Jacob, in his sense, the marker was a witness between the two men. Hey, you stand on your side, I'll stay on my side. Here's the threshold that we make sure why we're crossing. It's not for evil, it's for good. But in this example, this is not a deal between Jacob and another man. This is between Jacob and God.
It's an agreement.
It's agreement. He's setting up a pillar. Now, mind you, don't forget, God said, I hate these things. Okay? Don't forget, God says, I hate these things. So Jacob is setting this one up as a monument or marker, and Jacob's saying, this is the house of God. So he's marking what the house of God is. Now, mind you, where did God say his house was? Wherever he placed his name. Now, did God place his name on this rock? There's no indication God placed his name on the rock. But God places his name where he chooses. That's a place he chooses, and we discuss that later on the Torah portion. So mind you, God hates these objects, but yet men still use them. Now, this one obviously is not between two men. This is between Jacob and God himself, making some kind of a delineator, a placeholder. That if I make it back to this spot, God, I know you're with me, versus I know you're not with me. It's almost like it's something you can argue is a test. So you can debate, is this the kind of thing that God doesn't like? We can debate that. Larry, you have an opinion on it?
Well, it seems in this case, when it's Jacob, this is before they had the temple in Jerusalem, or even, I guess, what Moses was talking about is before that, but he knew it was going to happen, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't name the place where he's going to put his name. He names the place where he's going to put his name.
Right.
I was wondering, is this what they called the high places, where they had all these places?
This is one of the examples. The term itself, matzabah, it's intended to imply a religious memorial, a religious marker, a religious location or object to denote some kind of a relationship between you and a deity that you're dealing with. The case of Laban and Jacob, they invoked God's name as a witness. May God witness between the two of us, between these monuments we're building. So there's still a relationship between, as opposed to like a property boundary marker, that's between two neighbors. Hey, it doesn't matter who's watching, we see the marker's here. This is where it is. That's the idea between that concept. Well, the idea in this, both instances which you read, there's a third one we're going to go to shortly, discusses, well, this is between two of us in the case of Laban and Jacob, but that was for God to, as a witness, to verify this is actually happening according to what, because we're not going to be here all the time watching each other, but God will verify, will seal this covenant, so to speak, or double check it for us. In this instance, for Bethel, that Jacob, there is no deal between two men. It's between God and Jacob, and God doesn't like pillars, as he says. Now, but God doesn't necessarily disagree on Jacob's technique. So go to Genesis, our last verse, go to Genesis chapter 35, is where Jacob returns this particular pillar. Genesis chapter 35, he returns back to it to verify, say, hey, this is where he had been. Let's see here. It says, starting in verse 1. God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from Esau, your brother. So Jacob said to his household, to all who are with him, discard all the alien gods that are in your midst, cleanse yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel. I will make an altar there to God who answered me in my time of distress and was with me on the road that I traveled. So they gave Jacob all the alien gods that were in their possession, as well as the rings that were in their ears, and Jacob buried them underneath the Tabitha tree near Shechem. They set out, and there fell a godly terror on the cities which were around them. So they did not pursue Jacob's sons. Thus Jacob came to Luz, the land of Canaan, it is Bethel. He and all the people who were with him, he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, for it was there that God had been revealed to him during his flight from his brother. Deborah, the wet nurse of Rebekah, died. She was buried below Bethel, below the plateau. He named it Alon Bakut. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name should not always be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him his name Israel. And God said, I am El Shaddai, be fruitful and multiply, a nation of congregation of nations shall descend from you, and kings shall issue from your loins. The land that I gave to Abraham, to Isaac, I will give to you, and to your offspring after you I will give the land. Then God ascended from upon him in the place where he had spoken with him. Jacob set up a pillar at the place where God had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured a libation upon it, poured oil upon it. Then Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Bethel. So this is the example, and then they leave Bethel. So it's the same location where he had placed his pillar before, where he had the vision with the whole, you know, angels going up and down of heaven, all that stuff before. He had the vision, and he comes back to that. He sets it up again to the pillar. So in these examples, I bring up two questions because I want you to think about what this means. The nature relationship between God and Jacob, and what's happening in Jacob using these pillars as things which God later says, I hate them. I despise these things. Do not set them up. But Jacob is still setting them up. How do we rectify these differences? How do we handle this? Well, is Jacob doing something evil? Is he doing something wrong? Or is God just saying, well, I'm going to overlook it this time? What's the objective? What's the purpose behind it? Yes, Jonathan.
Did God possibly put his name there and Jacob somehow got the fact that God had already, that's where God had put his name?
Well, there's an interesting concept as far as history. I think I say history, that's not fair. But there's more to this story and what those pillars end up becoming. Yes, Jeff.
Well, it might be a good lesson in watching where God is at any given time. Because, for example, you know, he had things set up there in Shiloh, but then he took it down.
Yeah, take it down.
So then he even says, don't go looking there for me anymore.
I'm not there.
I'm not there anymore. But if you're saying, well, that's the only place where he could be, you would be wrong. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, you know, yes, the pillar was there. It was very important. It talked about what this encounter was, and that, you know, the Lord was specifically having this encounter with Yaakov right there. But it's like, okay, now I've revealed to you more. Here is the Shekinah right here in a specific place. Mm-hmm. So don't go looking for it at Bethel anymore.
Because it's not there anymore.
It's not there anymore.
Right.
Follow God where he says he is, not where you think he should be. Or where he was before.
Yep.
But he's now said he's moved on.
So it tells us that, well done explanation. It tells us that there is a period of events that humans live through. I live my life, you live yours. There are markers in your life, good and bad, that have happened over the years or decades. Some of them you remember them well and you learned great lessons from them, right? Some of you remember well, and you didn't learn anything from them. But you still remember them well because they didn't. You had to do it again. The lesson gets repeated. God moves just as you and I move. God's living just as you and I are living. So things change over time. Because God doesn't change himself, but he's a living being. So he lives as we live. And we learn and we grow. So we learn and see that God's pointing out that what happens in these pillars people set up, they become objects of noteworthy of worship or value. He hates that. Now we already understand God says he hates idols, right? We don't make an idol, don't make an image or anything. I get that. He's including rocks. Not just carved rocks, just ordinary rocks, because you put a meaning on them that is not right either. Now, history, or actually, I can't say history, that's a fair example. I say maybe legend, that's a better word, legend. Legends places it that this rock that Jacob used, they put his head up, put his pillar, was then transplanted from there to Jerusalem later on. And was used in all the kings of Israel, sorry, not Israel, of Judah, not of northern tribe, the southern tribe, were anointed king on this rock. Now, it's legend/tradition. The point is, that rock became an object in and of itself. It wasn't carved, didn't have eyeballs carved into it like an eye, like we can think of like the Buddha idols, or noses or mouths or ears. It was just a rock. But humans imparted something to it that in itself doesn't actually have value. Yeah, legend today argues that rock has been moved to England, and I again, it's all legends. But the point is, humans put a value on the object, even though the object wasn't even shaped like anything. So idols can go beyond just their, we think of, oh, well, there's a garden gnome. That's exaggeration, of course. There's a Buddha over here. It can go beyond that. Could be, oh, there's a rock over there that I happened to, that so-and-so did such and such on, and it was a long time ago, and no one remembers it, but save the rock.
Save the turtles.
It's a rock. Yeah, it's a rock. It's just a rock. Maintain, pay attention to what it actually means. So what does God hate about these things? It's what we do with them. It's our action we do with them. How do we use them or fail to use them? So as a result, he says, I hate them because we always do the same thing. Do we ever not? Well, maybe sometimes, but most of the time when we set up a big monument, have you ever been to monuments? Probably been to monuments in your lives, right? And there are things that have been made maybe 50 years ago, maybe 200 years ago, or maybe even 1,000 years ago. And we preserve them. Now, they could be grotesque things like the Colosseums in Rome, or they could be, you know, more modern-day happy-feeling type stuff they have. But the point is that we put value on them. That does not belong. They're still objects. So keep the value in functionality in mind. So that's what brings to your attention that the purpose of God's pointing out here is not necessarily the idea of a pillar or a monument. It's what we do with them. We end up allocating a function as if a great memory or great value or honor is put upon them. Okay, let's move forward. There's another thing I want to talk about, which is more interesting to me. Let's go to the judges section. So this is all these judges, chapter 17, death penalties and all these idol worshippers and such. I'm not going to go into every detail. Most of the stuff is pretty self-explanatory. Obviously, you know, don't worship other gods and yada, 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 rebellious people and whatnot. The first few verses of chapter 17 gives you basically an example of the type of judgments an ordinary city or town or tribal judge may run across. Idol worship within your city, within your dwelling place, within your tribe. Those things don't need to go to the high priest. They're things you can investigate and find out. They're really obvious. They did or they didn't. It's pretty basic. Either have witnesses or you don't. There is one thing I want to point out to you that this is listed twice in our Torah portion, the idea of multiple witnesses for things. Now, contextually, you see the topic that's being discussed here is mostly death penalty cases. The idea of two or three witnesses is mostly applied to death penalty cases, meaning as opposed to, you know, so-and-so stole my piece of candy. Stone him. That's just actually for two people. It's not a death penalty case. All right? You can debate it. Well, okay, maybe so-and-so, pay him back, blah, blah, blah. You can judge how you see fit. When a case, so-and-so killed what's-his-name over there. I watched it happen. Ah, now we're dealing with death penalty cases. So now we have to verify and find out if you're true. And find out true, they have to interrogate not the guilty party. You interrogate the witness. The witness is the one you interrogate. They're the one you focus as a judge your attention on. Are they telling the truth or not? Because if they're lying, what happens? They're the ones who get the death penalty. Okay. It's important. You're interested in the case, but you have to verify, is this witness real? Is it rehearsed? Is it altered away? Are they sticking with the story? Or do they have a background? It's the thorough investigation is not necessarily over the case itself as it is amongst the individuals who witnessed it. That's the more important and time-consuming case studies. is those cases. So that's what most of these judges are dealing with, is those sort of cases. But I'll bring something to your attention. Within this context, it says here, verse 8 of chapter 17, it says, if a matter is disputed in your cities, you shall rise, the priests and Levites, and the judge will be in those days. You shall inquire, and they shall tell you the word of judgment. You shall do according to the word that they tell you. From that place, Jehovah shall choose. You shall be careful to do according to everything that they teach you. According to the teaching that they will teach you, and according to the judgment that they will say to you, you shall do. You shall not deviate from the word they tell you, right or left. Now, if the man will act with willfulness, not listen to Cohen, who stands there to serve Jehovah your God, or to the judge, the man shall die, and they shall destroy the evil from amongst you. The other nation shall listen and fear, and they shall not act willfully anymore. Mind you, this is given with the instructions previously, judges not to take bribes. We read that earlier. Verse 16, the tale says, judges, you can't take bribes. It perverts justice, right? Hypothetical. You're brought before a judge. You're before the high priest or the priest, the judge of the land. But you know they're taking bribes. And they rule against you. What do you do? You have to obey their rule. Whether it's right or whether it's wrong, you obey the judgment. That's the law. Even if they're thoroughly corrupt. Mind you, like, well, but it's against our nature, but it was wrong, it was evil. Yes, it was wrong and it was evil. But it's not your place to correct it. You are the recipient of the judgment. Let God handle the corrections. Remember Eli and his sons? Let God handle the corrections. You are not placed as judge. You were put into that position as a judge over your judge. As a judge over your land, if you were put there, that's different, but you're not put there. They are put over you. Like it or not, they are put over you. So you, it's not your place to judge your judge. It's your place to receive the judgment and say, hey, I know this is wrong. I know this is evil. Because I know the judge has been paid, bought off by so-and-so who paid for this and made this little thing happen. You may know all that, but it's not your place to judge them. Whose place is it? Say this again. You're not responsible for your knowledge.
You can't believe nothing about it.
Ah,
right? Are you held responsible for the knowledge that you have?
When it comes to judgment, and you have all your heart believe that this event, these evil things are happening, and they're greater than you are, you can't fix them. You still receive judgment. You have to obey the judgment. That's not to say. You cannot go to the elders of your town or your village and say, hey, I believe so-and-so is taking a bribe. And this is the evidence I have. So those are accusations, but you have to be very, very careful with those. Because you don't just arbitrarily rattle it off, because then you're slandering that individual. Because you may be wrong. Maybe what you perceive, you may perceive what is incorrect. So mind you, we have multiple witnesses. When it comes to judging, it's very difficult to do. It's very difficult on you, on both the judge's side, because he can make mistakes, but you may perceive something that is actually factually wrong, but you think it. You saw so-and-so pay the judge money. See, it's a bribe. Oh, maybe so-and-so bought something from you didn't know, and that was just a payment because he bought a car. He paid the car back. You don't know the details. So be aware of what you see, what you observe may not be fully accurate. So just think, no buts. Accept the judgment. If something is wrong, let God handle out and just do not accuse, but be careful what you're holding on to, what you perceive is right. Yes, both Larry and Jeff.
So when the gavel goes down, it's over, and there's no appeal?
On the high courts, there is no appeal. This were the high priest, this the high priest and the judge of the whole country. So the Supreme Court, another example. Is it we use today? We talk the Supreme Court, or that's today they would use kings. Jeff,
yeah, because you know they're the later on in history, they would set up what we would have today as being your superior courts, your district courts, the appellate courts, kind of moved up from the town level to something that was a grievous incident, got all the way up to the grand Sanhedrin, the full sitting Sanhedrin, would hear the most grievous stuff. So there have been several layers that have gone up since then. Mm-hmm. But just to that note about, you know, accepting the judgment and basically letting, even if it's an, you could say, an evil judgment, the trials of Yeshua, Stephen,
evil judgments,
Paul appearing before the Sanhedrin.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Paul even said, "Hey, look, you know, I didn't realize that you're the
high priest,
the high priest." Okay, so slandering him was not what the Torah said that I should be doing. So he said, I repent of that. But what he said still stood there. Mm-hmm. And what Yeshua, what little he did say, when he was before the partial Sanhedrin, that stood in judgment against them. What Stephen said stood in judgment against them. So yeah, they were evil judges, but their evil judgment was a part of their own judgment. Mm-hmm. But that was heaven's response.
Heaven's response, yeah. It's no different than no different than lying. So the judge makes a mistake, right or wrong. If he knows he's making a mistake, he's doing it on purpose. Again, he's no different than a false witness against the individual he's judging. So the individual may receive the punishment, whatever it be. In this case, the two citations that Jeff was bringing up were both death penalty cases. So what's God going to do against that particular judge who was acting as a false witness now? The same goes back upon him. Death penalty case. And John, we have our New Testament says many, many times, you judge the same rod that you use to judge somebody else is used against you. It's the same rod, same measurement. It's not an easy one. So be very, very careful on them. So the nature of judges are important. So even if the judge we think is wrong, it doesn't really matter whether we think he's wrong or right. The judge is against you. Now, we have this example. This is the referring to the highest courts, meaning the high priest in the place that God puts his name. This is the judge of the land, that same chapter starts with the king. It's his judgment and the priest that's with him, the high priest is with him. Those two, there's no appeal beyond that. That's as high as you go. When they decree that's what it is. Now, I want to give citation examples to you. The king himself can be overruled by the high priest. Now, he may not accept it. He may say, you know, I'm going to kill you off because you disagree with me, but that's a separate issue. He can be overruled. So the judge of your land can be, in certain special circumstances, be overruled by the high priest. Well, how do I know that? Well, we have citation examples. So in the one example, we have actually the king overrules himself. I mean, he changes his own opinion, his own ruling. That's given in 2 Samuel chapter 16. And it discusses, as well as 2 Samuel 19, both 16 and chapter 19. David is dealing with a servant of Mephibosheth, and the servant claims Mephibosheth was happy or thrilled that David was being expelled because Absalom was taking over. And so David said, all right, well, fair enough. I'll believe you. All the things that Mephibosheth owns now belong to you, Mephibosheth's servant. And so David goes off. He has to deal with his Absalom and the fighting, the war that happens. And David returns after he defeats his own son. He returns to Jerusalem in chapter 19 and runs across Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth's in disheveled. He's not in a good condition at all. And David says, where were you? Mephibosheth said, my servant, the one who you awarded all my possessions to, deceived me. He was supposed to get the donkeys for myself and him to go catch up with you. But he took off. He lied to you about me. Now David says, okay, I already ruled. He gets all your stuff. But David says, but he gets half your stuff. See what happened? So David ruled initially, Ziba is the guy's name. The Ziba gets all of Mephibosheth's possessions, all of his land, everything, gets it all. That's his rulership. Now he's the king. You can't appeal beyond him. He's the stop. He's the end. But later on, he finds more information. He says, I'm going to alter my opinion. I'm all of a judge and just dividing your property in half. Now here's where Mephibosheth stands above the crowd and says, no. Your first ruling stood. Vision says, no, my servant gets all of it. Your ruling stands. So the king tried to overrule himself. And Mephibosheth said, no, I'm not. You're not going to overrule yourself. It is right. Whether it was right, meaning morally right, whether he was based on factual information or false information, based on a false witness. But the king didn't overrule himself, though he tried. So even in that instance, we have an example of even the king who could theoretically say, well, I'm changing my mind. Vision verse chapter 19 says, no, it's okay. Your ruling stands. Because there is nothing beyond you. What character does it show you about Mephibosheth? Now, he was ruled against him because the witness was lying about him. He was not there to defend himself, but he did not appeal to the situation at all, did he? What kind of character does that show you about that man? That's a humble character, very unique individual. Most would say, but he lied. Therefore, fix this. Mephibosheth says, no, he lied. Therefore, don't bother fixing it. It's okay. Now, Mephibosheth had some saving grace, so to speak, in that he was going to live at the king's table, him and his children, for their whole lives. So that wasn't a major loss, necessarily. But eventually, King David dies, and of course, Mephibosheth has to live on. He has to have inheritance and live their own lives after him. But the nature was still the nature of the rulership. Now, the other example, which I forgot the exact address, the chapter, but it's where the king Uzziah goes into the high priest's territory, into the temple, and wants to offer an offering to God. The high priest says, no, you can't do that. Now, the king says, I can. I'm making a rule that I can. I'm doing this. The high priest says, no, you can't. It wasn't given to you. So they have a dispute between the two, the king, who is the ultimate judge, and the high priest, who is the communication person of God. Now, the high priest did not commit a penalty against the king. God did that. But clearly, the high priest was trying to overrule the king's command. And what happened? God's side on the high priest's side, and king, here's your leprosy for the rest of your life. They had to leave and flee. So we even have within high priests, high priest has the ability, at least if he's righteous, to say, hey, judge, you've gone too far. You can't do this. You've gone to a corrupt way, a corrupt route. So we have even these high courts still have some wiggle room within them. The king can try to overrule himself if he sees an error, though it didn't work in Mephibosheth's case. And the high priest can say, king, you've gone too far. This is an incorrect decision you've made. So both those instances have that. Hence, we have our high court also. What do? They disagree. Our high court disagrees. They split. 5-4 or 7-3. All those different divisions. They argue amongst themselves and decide what is and what isn't right. And you still obey them. Like it or not, you still obey them. So again, these are all, because our judicial system is not that much different than the idea which God had set up in the Torah. It was based on the same concept in many ways. I'm out of time. So I'm going to jump through this, the tail end. Let's see here. Important parts. Okay. As your borders increase, you obviously have to tack on more and more of these cities of refuge, which we read about that. But you do not get to change the original markers. So, draw a brief map here. You may theoretically have, which happens, should happen again in the future. I'm not sure when, but God's timing, right? So you have Israel, right? Ooh, marker's dead. Where'd the black marker go? I had it a minute ago. Oh, here it is. So, Israel. Oops. Got sloppy with my handwriting here. You may have different territories as such broken up in Israel, right? You have, obviously, Judah's generally, it's the cities here, Jerusalem's roughly around there, give or take, actually a little higher. You have different boundaries, different sections, all broken up. You have Manasseh and Gad and Reuben over here, M, G, and R. And then you have Ephraim's here. The other half of Manasseh's here. You have Dan over there and Dan up top there. The point is, you have Zebulun and Issachar up here. They all broke up in Judah's down here, along with Benjamin here. And Simeon's down here as well, scattered amongst them. So you have all these different territories. The point is, you may expand, but this stays fixed. So let's say Manasseh says, I'm going to live in modern-day Iraq. Guys, that's fine. You have that too. But you don't move from here to there. You keep this. So you can be scattered amongst different spots. Your own tribal territories will be scattered to a checkerboard style. It could be all over the place. Doesn't matter. You don't get to change these original inheritance boundaries. They always stay fixed forever. But as you expand, since the refuge must be built up in those places to where it's a short distance travel, does it make an error, a mistake for a death penalty case, if it could be, if they made something that wasn't an accident, for example, there's a place to go to that's quickly to get there. We today call them jails. In some version, you can get to jail. We don't have to say, oh, I have to go to jail in New York. All right, get there. Good luck. We have them very close by for a lot of reasons, lots of criminals. But the point is, you have place of protection where vengeance can be put upon you while you're trying to flee there. So as you expand, God's laws expand with you, but they stay fixed where they originally were as well. So just because the expansion does not negate the original law, the original plan. The expansion just increases it, its scope, its level, its size. But the original stays the same. I'm going to end real quick here, because I'm already past time. As I mentioned before, not all cases are the whole two and three witnesses. Some cases don't require two or three witnesses. They're just trying to investigate and finding out. Again, tradition, because it mentions again, obviously, in chapter 18, it says the same thing about two or three witnesses, as far as how you're deciding something. What I want to end with, however, is the nature of which God speaks to you. He says you don't get to talk to necromancers, mediums, sorcerers, any of those people, right? Who does God give to us to listen to? Prophets. When was the last time you guys met a prophet? I never met one. I've never met a prophet. I'm not going to go there. People's opinions on who is and who isn't. Yeah. They already wrote stuff down. And what does God say about prophets? What is his command? Because they ask, it says, in this chapter 18, tail end of 18, it talks about this. Is when you ask, how do we know this prophet's telling us the truth or not? Comes to pass, but we also learned earlier in chapter 13 of Deuteronomy, it says, hey, if a prophet says something that came to pass, but he also says, go follow this other God, other tradition, other way of life, both are evil. You don't get to do that. Don't get to change your tradition, don't get to change your way of life, don't get to change the laws that you live by. Those laws stay fixed, much like the property stays fixed, regardless of how big you are. Everything stays fixed, it doesn't change with you. So if somebody says, but God said this, and now let's go worship this thing over here, because he said it's a good thing to do, he's lying to you. It doesn't matter if what he said was what came to pass, we have to test these events. Now we don't actually have active prophets, in my opinion, I should say, sorry. In my opinion, we no longer have active prophets today. I hold that opinion pretty strongly, but that's mine. So I don't have these tests to use. So what do I use? Just the Bible itself. That's my personal prophet technique or uses. Now, it doesn't tell me what the lottery tickets are going to be. It can predict I'm going to lose, which is probably right. That's about as successful as any prophets are to me. But anyway, so our nature of our questions don't get answered by seeking an individual to give us answers. The nature of our questions are answered by God answering them, and he has his instructions on how to deal with issues and problems and the things that arise. Stick with that method, and you'll do well. Deviate from the method, you'll be humiliated, or just plain led astray. Neither of which are good. Yes, Jonathan.
So when Yeshua talks about the helper coming, his helper coming, how does that play into the role of us deciphering what his will is?
Ah, so when you're dealing with a high, or when you deal with the Spirit of God working with you, there's a lot of people's opinions on how that works. The functionality was that God would reveal within inside your spirit what is consistent from him, all right? So generally speaking, you probably have dealt with this. You have kids, of course you have. When one of your kids are lying to you, sometimes it's pretty obvious. Sometimes not quite so obvious. Sometimes they get better as they get older at it. Like, is he telling the truth or not? Unfortunately, it does. It does happen, right? We've all been there. But if enough time lapses and observation happens, you say, well, something doesn't quite ring true on this. I can't quite pinpoint what it is. So you could observe by the own observation of your own child, something's fishy. I don't know what it is, but something seems a little fishy. It may not be known at now, might know it in a week from now. As they remember, they told us, guess what I did when they talked to their sibling? They said, yeah, you know they were lying. They deceived you. So things like that help you in we call it intuition or understanding. Well, God's understanding is greater than that. He's using his Torah as your understanding tool. See, I'm going to help you. I did it when someone's lying to you about me with inside what I've already said. We have to trust what God said. His words are how he revealed himself to us is only through words. So what he said is what has to stay true. And with his spirit, the idea is that spirit will engrave something that doesn't ring true. What's being told me doesn't sound quite right. I know there's something off with this versus I know this is true because I've read the concept behind it. It makes sense with what the Torah instructs, what his words say. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, because that passage that you're referring to there in John specifically says just what he just said, that he will remind you of the things that I've told you. So thus, when you're asking for the Spirit's insight, it's like, point me to what you said. Mm-hmm. And thus, you know, you've probably experienced that too. You know, when you're truly seeking for that answer, seeking for that wisdom, where do you get directed? To the things that you've read, which always is predicated by you had to have actually read them before.
Details.
You have to have actually read them to be reminded
right.
of them.
Right, right. Any questions or comments? I'm well over time, so you want to share? We'll close the prayer then, if you don't mind. Almighty God, our gracious Father, thank you for our Shabbat, a day of rest, our time with you to study and to pray and to listen and to understand. Help us, Father, to understand and to apply these great things you've taught us to our lives, to our way of living, the direction you've given to us, Father, our paths. Please bless our paths, Father. They do what is good and right in your eyes, and you will guide us. We will hold on to you wherever you lead us. We praise you and ask you will judge us well, Father. And we praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.